This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
66, some fog out there. Be careful. Headlights on. Four-way flashers only if you're stopped. I'll say that before people start texting. Highs of 80 tomorrow. Rough weather coming through. That's why the St. Patrick's festivities were canceled. Maybe a chance for tornadoes. Some hail could be primarily late morning, early afternoon. Then it clears out. Sunday is going to be beautiful. Highs of 72. St. Petty's Day itself. Highs of 71. And then you skip a day, which is beautiful. 74 for a high. Then Wednesday, St. Joseph's Day. Che La Luna, highs of 77, so a nice day, a nice week all the way through with no rain. What's it going to be like on Wall Street? I don't know, kind of cloudy perhaps. We're talking with Walter Dubb Lane, our friend, a professor of associate professor of economics and finance at my alma mater, UNO. How you doing, Dubb?
Yeah, doing fine. Thank you, Tommy.
Oh, I forgot to give this in the weather, a 30% chance of widely scattered stockbrokers jumping out of the windows on Wall Street.
A lot of nervousness out there, for sure.
Well, let's talk about this because you got a political concern and you got an economic concern. I think those that favor President Trump are going to say, yeah, but wait, there's going to be gain after the pain. There's a lot of confusion over tariffs because they go back to McKinley. McKinley was using tariffs in that late 1800 time period to raise revenue, not necessarily to build production in the United States. Trump even alluded to that himself. Take me through all of that, please, and tell me where we are.
Well, one thing that the vast majority of economists agree on is that, in general, tariffs are bad, in the sense that free trade is what's really best for everybody. It allows us countries to specialize in what they do best and trade and buy things cheaper that other people can make cheaper than they can. A lot of economists are very nervous about tariffs. Now, there are some times when selective tariffs make a whole lot of sense. You know, we've had a problem with a country like China, who's been, subsidizing a lot of their products into the United States. Tariffs there might be appropriate, certainly, you know, tariffs to protect the national interest, things of that sort. But in general, the kind of cross-the-board tariffs, certainly what we're talking about in Canada and Mexico and now back in Europe, those don't make sense to most economists, and it could really hurt the overall economy, especially because we've already seen it with Europe, in that we tariff some certain type of things in terms of aluminum, things of that sort, and they respond by tariffing our whiskey, and now we're going to say we're going to tariff their wine, what's called reciprocal tariffs. And then that's called a trade war. And we see certainly that building up and with both Canada, Mexico, and in Europe right now.
But just to be clear, when people hearken back to McKinley and tariffs, that's apples and oranges. That's not the same manufacturing situation in the world or the United States that it now that it was then, right? I mean, it's kind of really hard to say that it worked for McKinley, so it'll work now.
Well, again, remember, as you said, early on, tariffs had to do with getting revenue for the government because we hadn't created the income tax yet, things of that sort. And so now we don't think of them. They do produce revenue for the government, but that's not the major purpose of tariffs these days. We've got plenty of income taxes and corporate taxes to take care of that. So tariffs are now really talked about as either, for the purpose of, Trump has talked about them in all kinds of ways. He started off with some with Colombia trying to make sure that they would take the deportees that were sending back. In fact, that's what many economists are wondering about with Mexico and, with Mexico and Canada, he's talking about reducing fentanyl and people coming across the border as opposed to really just pure economics. So, and some economists still feel that Trump is doing this as a negotiating tool. We'll try to hit him with some tariffs, and then we'll negotiate for some better trade relations or various other things. And if that's what he's doing, then if it works, maybe that's okay. But if he's really doing tariffs just to do tariffs, as he said, to try to protect American jobs, that doesn't work.
Well, let me pick it up there when we come back, because that brings us to what's going on with the market, the effect that tariffs is having on the stock market. Markets go up, markets go down. My film education dub at UNO got me to like old movies, okay? And there are a couple of movies that people can look at. Everybody tends to think of Wall Street Shenanigans in terms of what was the 1980s movie Wall Street? But actually, there are movies, Patterns, that was made in 1956, Executive Suite, that was made in 1954. Tells the story of all kind of shenanigans going on in boardrooms and selling stock short and so forth. And I would guess since the market started, there have been people that have been trying to find ways to manipulate it, right? So tariffs have the market down now, but if the tariffs work as a negotiating tool and everybody hangs in there, does the market come back up? And how do you separate the economy and tariffs and manufacturing from the stock market and people's 401ks, because the economy is a whole bunch of different things. We'll try to help sort it out some more with Walter Dublane when we come back, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO, talking about tariffs and inflation and President Trump and the economy. And right now it's time for traffic on WWL. 6:25 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Walter Dublane, our friend, professor, Associate Professor of Economics and Finance at my alma mater, UNO. Somebody texted in and looked. Politically, there are people that think Donald Trump can walk on water. There are people that think he is going to bring the nation underwater. I'm neither. I don't know. I think people need to delineate between process and results. I think some people may disagree with the process right now, but I think it's kind of early to talk about results other than the stock market, and that goes up, that goes down. Let me read this text real quick, and I'll give it back to you. All countries have had tariffs on U.S. goods for an eternity. No president had the gonads to step up, make the tough call. Long term, it'll benefit our kids. Trump is the best business negotiator there has ever been. He'll force other countries to come to the negotiating table. When do we know? When will we know? Because take it, Dub, if you will, about the entire economy as it relates to the stock market, because I don't think with the situation, I don't think manufacturing is going to come back to the United States. If it does, prices are going to go up. That's just the way the world market is. If that happens, what happens with inflation? And when it comes to the stock market, how long will something like that take to rebound? That's a lot to unpack. So go ahead. You're a professor. Go where you feel, jump in where you feel comfortable.
Yeah. Yes. Well, of course, the stock market, is very, very much afraid of chaos and volatility. And of course, whatever else he does, Trump breeds chaos. And so the stock market is going to be responding partly to that. But again, if you think about the individual companies, so obviously, if you're trying to sell whiskey in Kentucky right now, or you're a soybean farmer up in the middle of the country trying to sell soybeans, we're going to see a lot of reciprocal tariffs that will hurt those people. His focus seems to be bringing manufacturing back that's been gone overseas. And he also has the standard that says if we have a trade deficit with any country, which we do with almost every country, that they're taking advantage of us. And I think, to me, that's one of the big misunderstandings that most people don't really get, which is the only way we can have a trade deficit. When we have a trade deficit, you know, we're buying more of their goods than we're selling to them. And that doesn't sound right. But the only way that can happen is when we buy their goods, we send them dollars. Mm-hmm. And so the only reason they're going to take the dollars is if they want to do something with it. And what happens a lot of these things is they do their dollars and they invest in the United States in our assets. If they didn't do that, then the exchange rates would alter to make, you know, some goods, our goods more expensive and their goods cheaper, and then trade deficit would go away. And so that side of it that almost nobody talks about is that there's a reason that we have trade deficits, and it's not just the other countries taking advantage of us. The reason we have trade deficits is the other countries find the United States a very good place to invest. And that doesn't seem like such a bad thing to me.
So, Dub, with the minute that's left here, leaving the politics out of this, for those that are concerned, stop. For those that, I have to work from home, Dub, I'm sorry. For those that are concerned about, it's Teddy and Tommy in the morning, apparently. For those that are concerned about their 401ks and about inflation and about prices, again, politics aside, okay, how do we know if we win or lose, or if the country wins or loses, if the average citizen wins or loses this economic economic conflict that's going on?
Well, again, one thing we know for sure, that if Trump persists with these broad-based tariffs across the board, inflation will go up. There's no way of avoiding that. Now, is that, as he says, something that's somewhat temporary and we'll work through it and then the whole economy will be better off 2 years down the road? That's a lot less certain. But we know that the short-term effects are going to be negative on the economy and negative on inflation. And at least for a while, unless he's using his negotiating techniques, and we've seen that where he backs off after a little while, that the broad-based tariffs are bad for the economy, bad for inflation.
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. 504-260-1870, that's the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text Line. Do you have faith in what President Trump is doing, and do you think you're going to be better off economically? You, and give me a time frame on it if you can. At what point? 504-260-1870. I'm neither blue or red. I'm green. I'm concerned with the financial health of myself and the country and everybody else. 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:45, come on. 6:45, Friday morning, finally. Seems like a long week, and I was thinking the other day how I was really kind of more tired than ever, and I think it's because of daylight saving time. I think that does kind of take a lot more out of us than we realize. Highs of 80 today, then that chance for severe weather tomorrow. Late morning, early afternoon, but it should move through pretty quickly. Unfortunately, a high risk for, unusually high risk for some severe weather, hail or tornadoes, those kind of things. So keep it on WWL or download the app. We'll let you know everything you need to know as you need to know it. And then Sunday, perfect. Highs of 72, plenty of sunshine. St. Petty's Day on Monday, highs of 71, plenty of sunshine. Tuesday is going to be perfect. And then skip ahead to Wednesday, St. Joseph's Day, highs in the mid-70s. Then it turns even cooler. Thursday, highs of 67 and beautiful throughout the first part of next weekend. Jeff Palermo joins us now, our friend, WWL.com. Columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, talks some LSU sports. How you doing, Jeff?
Doing well, Tommy. How about yourself?
I am well, sir. Thank you. I got to work from home because of a little technical glitch going on or issue going on at the station. So you might hear Teddy the puppy in the background. It might be the Teddy and Tommy show this morning. Just warning you, all right?
That's all right. No problem. Dog lover here.
Are you really? You have a dog or not?
Yes, I do have a dog. Yes.
What kind of dog?
I have a Cocker Spaniel.
Wait, what's his name? Her name?
It is a boy. His name is Peyton, P-A-Y-T-O-N.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, this is Teddy the Mutt, because we're both mutts. Anyway, let's talk about LSU. Let me begin with men's basketball. How much of a mess is that program?
Well, it was really a disappointing season, and it came to an end on Wednesday night, and I don't know if anybody really recognized that it ended. I mean, mm-hmm. The interest fell off the table with the program. It is, you know, this is Matt McMahon's third season, the second year that you know, he's only won just a couple games. And, you know, when you have sports like football and women's basketball and gymnastics and baseball and softball and all these programs are ranked in the top 10, and this is one of the worst power four programs in the country, LSU fans are not going to really give it a lot of its attention. So from what we've been told, Matt McMahon's going to be back for a fourth season. They're going to try to increase the NIL budget, and we'll see if that works. Yes, getting better players here, having more money, more resources to get better players here, that will help. But my concern is that LSU is so far down in the hole. I mean, how much, you know, if they do increase the NIL and put more money as far as trying to get player talent to that roster, they got just such a long way to go. And then we really don't know, because of the talent level, it's been so low, especially two of these three seasons with Matt McMahon, just really how good of a coach he is. You know, when he has the players, can he win at this level? Because there's some really good coaches in the Southeastern Conference, and can he match up with them? And after 3 years, you really don't have an answer to that question.
Tell me, Will Wade is tearing it up in the Southland Conference, right? So refresh people, because you talk about apathy and maybe men's basketball flying underneath the radar, and I, like you, I'm concerned about the hole that they're in, because first thing I do is stop digging. Then now it seems like it might be, I don't know, with NIL, is it harder or easier to get out of that hole?
Well, you look at a school like Missouri. Missouri was in the same place as LSU was a year ago, and if not worse. And here they are. They're going to probably head to the NCAA tournament this year. South Carolina was one of the best teams in the SEC last year, and then they lose a bunch of players, and they're at the bottom of the SEC standings, just like LSU. So yeah, it could be very volatile, where you could turn things around, and it is basketball, and you can only play five guys at a time. And if you get two or three really good players, it completely turns your program around. But is LSU able? Can they get to where they want to get to as far as sustained success, where you're good every single season instead of this just roller coaster? You win two or three games one season and boom, you jump up to, you know, 12, 13, 14 wins. You know, that's they had, you know, since the Dale Brown era, the closest thing they have had to sustained success was under Will Wade, where they were making regular trips to the NCAA tournament, at least during his short time that he was at LSU. And it looked like LSU every year would be a team that would at least finish with a 500 record or better, a winning record, and be in the conversation to get into the NCAA tournament. They haven't even come close with that with Matt McMahon.
And when it comes to the reasons for Will Wade leaving, in today's environment, there would have been no reason for him to leave, right?
No reason for him to leave, but the other thing you have to remember when the investigation was looking into Will Wade providing recruits with improper benefits, when the NCAA was investigating that, they were also investigating the situation with the football program involving a former booster who ended up going to federal jail because of some things that he did with money and so forth. And for LSU for LSU to save the football program, they had to fire Will Wade as part of it. They had to show that they had to show that they had the situation under control, and then they were not allowing this to occur with two major sports where recruits were basically getting paid or getting no-show jobs, as was the case as part of that football investigation for LSU. So it was an unfortunate thing for Will Wade. I think there is members of the LSU fan base that still have not forgiven Scott Woodward for doing that, and they're not going to really give Matt McMahon much of a chance, because they They still want Will Wade to be the head coach, and Will Wade, as you mentioned, is thriving 2 hours to the west of LSU and probably will be looking for a big-time job in college basketball this season once McNeese's run through the NCAA tournament is done. So I don't see LSU going back to the days of Will Wade, and they'll probably, you know, if there's a big opening in the SEC, if something happens, they may have to be competing with Will Wade, which we've seen. One thing that Will Wade could do is he finds talent, and he knows how to put rosters together. And I think that you saw that at LSU, and he's done that very well, obviously, in McNeese. They've been nearly unstoppable there in the Southland Conference.
I don't know if you've ever written a book or not or thought about it, but an interesting book I think would be on not, you know, the house settlement with back pay and everything else, but I think an interesting book would be to look back and see how programs, major programs, have changed because of things just a few years ago that were so wrong that now is just the way of doing business. Go back and document that.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it's certainly, you know, for Will Wade's part, you know, it's the new times help him. I think, you know, and he served his time.
Because that's, you know, how he was conducting business in the old days, right, Jeff?
Yeah, he was, you know, and he served his time because obviously what he did was against the NCAA rules, and he had to sit out for a season, and he's basically had to start his coaching career all over again. And I think you got to give credit to McNeese's athletic director, Heath Schroyer, for making the decision. It wasn't, a lot of people said, wait a minute, this guy, you know, Will Wade, he's kind of a, you know, he's a rule breaker. He's this, he's that. Well, those rules are no longer in place. And what he is he's a really good basketball coach, and he gets kids to play for him, you know, very hard. And again, his ability to just to put a roster together on the fly. I mean, he even did that in his first season. His first season at LSU, he made that a very competitive team that got into the NIT, and then the next year they were, you know, in the NCAA tournament. So I don't know. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, Tommy, you know, we're 3 years into this with Matt McMahon, and it's just really hard to say whether he's the answer or not. He hasn't had the resources to do it.
Before I let you go, and I want to talk baseball and ladies basketball, we can do that another time. I just want to put a cap on the LSU men's basketball season here. How important to the fan base is men's basketball?
Well, when it's winning and they're going to the NCAA tournament, there is just an absolute buzz within the fan base. Mm-hmm. But when it's like this, I think the LSU fan base is fine with rooting on for baseball and, you know,
ladies
getting
basketball
ready for spring
and football,
football,
right?
and enjoying Mardi Gras season and all those other things that occur during basketball season. So it's not like it's football where it's, I don't want to say it's life or death, but it means so much for that football program to be successful. But as we've seen, LSU athletics can still be very popular and still be very profitable, even if men's basketball is not doing its part.
And we had to go, but 86 the last time made the Final Four, right?
No, they made the Final Four in 06.
06, that's right, okay.
Yeah, with John Brady. And that was a fun team. That was an absolute fun team, and everybody got behind it with Glenn Davis and Tyrus Thomas and Daryl Mitchell and, you know,
we gotta
those
go,
are fun
Tim.
Times.
I'm sorry,
they
Tim. They're telling me we had to go. I'm sorry. That's my fault. Thank you, sir. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist and Louisiana Network News Director. Time for traffic now, WWL. It's 7:16. It is St. Patrick's Day Eve. Eve? I got to get my Eve straight. Anyway, we thought we'd talk about the history of St. Patrick and Ireland and put some truth behind the conversation. I know once I went to Loyola one semester and took a history of Catholicism course because it was required. You know how you read things sometimes and paragraphs just stick out in your mind? And at that time, I was marching in the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And look, no disrespect to anybody, but I remember the paragraph said, St. Patrick himself would be horrified at the excesses and the celebrations that have been taken on in his name. And I'm not trying to ruin anybody's fun. We just thought we'd look at the history of Ireland since everybody celebrates and everybody wants to be Irish on St. Patrick's Day. Brian McGovern joins us now, professor of history at Kennesaw State University. How are you, Prof?
I'm doing well. How about yourself?
I'm all right, sir. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you. Is McGovern an Irish name?
It is indeed, yes.
And have you traced your people back to what county?
County Cavan.
Okay. I've been to Ireland. It was a seven-day whirlwind tour. A lot of counties this, a lot of counties that.
Yes.
I do remember going to County Cork. I remember I went to, obviously, Dublin. And then there was the, what's the one that Bing Crosby sings in a Christmas song?
Is that, he does Killarney.
Killarney, yeah. And I also got confused with Melikaliki Maka because I went to Hawaii, too. But that's not why you're here.
Yeah.
Let's talk about St. Patrick's Day in America, and how did it become such a big thing?
So I think a lot of it stems back in the 1700s. The first Irish St. Patrick's Day parade would have been 1737 in Boston. And so this would have been a celebration of people who were trying to assert an identity, but also trying to make their way in a new place. At that time would have been part of the British Empire, American colonies. And by the 1760s, we start to see parades on an annual basis in New York and even the island of Montserrat in the Caribbean. Around the same time started to have these parades to celebrate the holiday.
Was this always directly associated with Catholicism and the church, or did it kind of at some point veer off?
No, in fact, the earliest immigrants from Ireland to, or at that point would have been migrants from, typically would have been Protestant. And so we really don't see Irish Catholics outnumbering Irish Protestants coming to the United States until the 1830s. And then by the 1840s with the Great Hunger is when we really start to see the influx of Irish Catholics.
And at some point, that's when green got adopted. Is that where we stand here? Because we always associate green with St. Patrick's Day, and some people think because, I guess it's because the island is so green. I don't know. How did we get to, has green always been the color of St. Patrick's Day, or did it change at some point?
Yeah, so it actually used to be associated with the color blue. And there's some mythology about Ireland being represented, Irish sovereignty being represented by the color blue, a woman wearing a blue robe in Irish mythology, which would have gone back 8th, 9th centuries. But if you fast forward in 1783, I believe, there was an Order of St. Patrick, which was an Anglo-Irish society, actually adopted a blue flag. And so that's when you really start to see this association of blue with St. Patrick. And so it's not until the 1790s that you really start to see green associated with Ireland. Now, you had seen before that, in 1640s, there was a group known as the Irish Catholic Confederation. They adopted a green flag. And so that was sort of associated with a form of nationalism that was associated with Catholicism. But the reality is, I think a lot of people don't know that the earliest nationalists in Ireland were Protestants. They tended to be of Scottish descent, tended to be Presbyterians, maybe Baptists. And in 1798, there was a rebellion that took place by a group known as the United Irishmen that were led by Protestants, also included a number of Catholics as well involved. But they're the ones who really adopted green as the symbol of nationalism. And so before that, Yeah, go ahead.
Let me take a break, Professor. When we come back, having been to Ireland, I find the story of the Great Hunger, the famine, interesting, because I think history has kind of revised that, or people that don't know their history think that it was just something that happened with a weather event or whatever it was that caused a potato famine. But I believe, unless I'm wrong.
Hey, I'm Andy. If you don't know me, it's probably because I'm not famous. But I did start a men's grooming company called Harry's. The idea for Harry's came out of a frustrating experience I had buying razor blades. Most brands were overpriced, overdesigned, and out of touch. At Harry's, our approach is simple. Here's our secret. We make sharp, durable blades and sell them at honest prices for as low as $2 each. We care about quality so much that we do some crazy things, like buy a world-class German blade factory. Obsessing over every detail means we're confident in offering a 100% quality guarantee. Millions of guys have already made the switch to Harry's, so thank you if you're one of them. And if you're not, we hope you give us a try with this special offer. Get a Harry starter set with a 5-blade razor, weighted handle, shave gel, and a travel cover, all for just $3 plus free shipping. Just go to harrys.com and enter code SHAVE at checkout. That's harrys.com, code SHAVE. Enjoy.
So I read in USA Today that the majority of people stop GLP-1 weight loss injection shots in a year. Now, what's concerning is if you get off GLP-1s, there's a real chance you can gain all the weight back. The solution? Alma said, a natural superfood protein shake. University studies show it optimizes your metabolism so you can lose weight easily, and Alma said it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Use Alma said with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at almased.com. That's almased.com.
Hey, I'm Josh Fink, owner of Nick's Menswear. Getting married? Don't rent some random suit. At Nick's, we help you own the look for about the same price as a rental. You're marrying the love of your life. Don't you deserve a suit that's yours forever? Nick's Menswear, your friend in style.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
There was enough to feed the people there. It was the Protestants and Trevelyan that decided not to do that. We can go more into that when we come back. 722, talking about Ireland and St. Patrick's Day and more. 722 now, traffic WWL. Quickly back to Professor Brian McGovern, history professor at Kennesaw State University. You hear the fields of Athenry behind us. Professor, when it comes to the famine, when it comes to the troubles between the Protestants and the Catholics, a lot of people attribute it to religion, but it's a lot deeper than that, is it not?
Oh, it certainly is. There have been a number of Protestants over the years who have been nationalists. There have been a number of Catholics throughout the years who have been very loyal to Great Britain. They became more sectarian in the 19th century, and so that's when you start to see the shift between nationalism being led by Protestants to becoming almost exclusively Catholic by the end of the basically the beginning of the 20th century. But there were a number of Protestants who took part in the Easter Rebellion, who took part in the War for Independence as well. So it's certainly more complicated than just Catholic versus Protestant.
Tell me about St. Patrick himself. What do we know about it and the shamrock and that tradition?
Yeah, we don't know a whole lot about. Much of what we know is based on something he had written that he entitled Confessio, in which it's essentially a declaration of his faith. And he talks a little bit about himself, but we believe that he was born in Wales, that his name was originally Maelyn Suchet. We're not exactly sure. You know, we just don't have the evidence for this. We believe that his father was a deacon and was a Roman British official. And so we know that he was one of many missionaries. He had been captured by Irish pirates, escaped, went back to Ireland, and he was one of many missionaries who were trying to convert them from paganism to Catholicism.
I'm sorry, Professor, finish, please.
No, I was just going to say the notion that he used the shamrock to preach about the Trinity, there's probably no truth to that, and there's certainly no truth that he drove the snakes out of Ireland either.
Well, never let the truth get in the way of a good story, right?
Exactly.
Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. Hope we get to talk to you again. Have a great St. Patrick's Day. Brian McGovern, Professor of History at Kennesaw State University. We'll come back. Speaking of the green, we'll help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union, when we return. Time now, WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, from the wearing of the green to the saving of the green, or the spending of the green, or whatever's going on with your money. Help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Happy Friday, sir. I'm doing
happy
well.
Happy Friday to you as well. And I just want to ask you a question, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want. I've been known to place large sports bets when I feel confident, okay? But
that's right.
I would never short a stock. I would never have the cojones to do that. Would you or not?
I've done that, Tommy, and that's a kind of a rare thing for me. I know people that have done that just more casually. And it takes a little bit of courage. Let's call
Man,
it that.
I'm telling you, unless you got some kind of inside information, it's one thing to hit a free throw at the buzzer, but man, to talk about a stock, you better have what you put up. You better have it. Go ahead.
Well, for our listeners, I mean, it's when you buy a stock, you have a limited downside and unlimited upside. Okay, the stock could go on forever. And that's the beauty of a buy. But if you're shorting one, you're betting that the stock could go down. It can only go to zero. So you have a limited downside, but what could go wrong? Well, the stock could move against you. In this case, it could go up. So just if somebody's trying to understand what short selling is, mm-hmm. it's the unlimited upside that pulls in that courage word like you were just talking mm-hmm. about. So you're sitting on, I mean, it's like being strapped to a bomb to a certain extent. And there are other ways to make money off of down markets that kind of put a fence around the trade. So you don't have that unlimited upside. Because if, you go out to lunch and come back, and if the stock went in the wrong direction, you could be sitting with a very substantial loss. So that's why when people, Tommy, they have mutual funds that do nothing but short sell. Mm. They look for overvalued stocks, they short sell them, and it's a contrary trade because that's the minority of people are placing short trades. But it's a strategy, and people do it, but you've got to watch it like a hawk because of what we said.
I didn't know cojones meant courage. I'll have to look that up. Let's talk about we were talking to Dr. Dub Lane from UNO earlier about the market and knowing what you own in your investments and year-to-date performance, and that's certainly a part of what people are concerned with, Mark, when it comes to managing their money.
Tom, I was looking at the financial news this morning. I just read an article title. It says Trump and Powell are playing from the same strategy book, waiting for tariffs to land and for the Fed to respond, meaning that investor discomfort is the only sure thing. So I couldn't help but read that to us because it summed up so much. Mm-hmm. The market volatility, stock market doesn't like, Wall Street doesn't like uncertainty. They would like, steady as she goes and everything's on the table and everything's quiet. And let's make a little money off our investments. But from the tariffs and the tax policy, the federal employee layoffs, we've yet to see that come into the unemployment rate or to the extent that it will. Fed decisions are all on the table. We have been under Fed watch for the last 3 years, so that continues to haunt us. And last but not least, attached to the Fed decision or the inflation issues. And it's enough new administration, it's enough uncertainty. So you got that volatility in markets. But for instance, we had the CPI and PPI come out this week, and it was generally good news. And in January, the CPI went up by 0.5%. That's a 6% annual rate. That is not good news. So not one data point does a trend make, so let's wait till the next month. So we just got that this week for February. It was lower than expected. It's at 0.2%. So that would be a 2.4% annual rate. And that's keeping the Fed at bay to say, okay, every now and then you get a blip, and then ideally it will settle back down to some type of normality. And if it stays in that 2-point-something% range, and that's where they're going to feel comfortable, we talked about this last week, a little bit more comfortable in saying, well, interest rates continue to be too high. I mean, after all, they increased rates by over 5%. and they gave back 1% in the fall. But ask anybody in banking, I mean, I am one to say, no, we would love the interest rates to come down a little bit for a number of reasons. The PPI comes out right the next day, again this week. In January, it was up more, a little bit high number, 0.4%. So that's a 4.8% annual rate. What was it in February? Zero. Much lower than expected. A 0.3% was expected. It came in at zero. So, you know, some of these year-over-year numbers are falling to decent levels on the CPI. The year-over-year is 2.8, and the PPI is 3.2. But it's, again, just from that article title that I was reading, that it keeps the Fed on. They're watching it like a hawk, as they should. And it's their job to keep inflation tame. But it's these other things of what the government is doing on the fiscal side, what the president's doing, is that going to stoke up inflation? And that's, you know, a lot of people, I think I'm in that number to say, oh, the tariff activity, it's going to be temporary. I'm thinking he's shaking up some of these governments and talking about imbalances of trade. And, you know, I think that we've seen it. We saw where he was going to raise tariffs on Colombia, and they corrected themselves in one day. Okay, we give up. Well, and, you know, it's hard for another country to stand in the way of the largest economy on earth. So I think that has been a tool to bring them to the bargaining table. We'll see how it plays out. But in the meantime, what are we seeing? Well, Tom, it's interesting because it depends on what you own. And we talked about that before. And on the Dow, year to date, it's down 4%. So we hear about other numbers that are being floated around. I looked it up this morning. On the S&P, we're down slightly more at 6%. Okay, so those aren't volatility measures that'll bring, you know, you're scrambling to get on the roof to throw yourself off. Those are relatively tame. If you're looking at the set of stocks have been labeled the Magnificent Seven, the ones that over the past couple of years were really responsible for the majority of some market growth. And they're big companies, and when they move, they tend to get a lot of attention, and they move the markets up. But again, depending on what you own, if you got a portfolio of mature stocks that are similar to the Dow 30, you're hardly noticing with a 4% downturn of the Magnificent Seven. And I'll rattle those off very quickly: Nvidia, Tesla, Google, Amazon, names that we know, Meta, Microsoft, and Apple. Well, if you had a portfolio that was filled with these stocks, Tesla is the one that's leading the down charge. They're 40% down. So I could see somebody saying, well, yeah, my portfolio is down, you know, 25, 30, 35, 40. I know people that invest in Tesla directly, and they're not having any fun right now. If they held on to the stock, they're down 40% year to date. So that's beyond, I heard Dave saying before, it's, you know, that the Dow is one of the market averages that are in correction territory. Well, not really, not yet, not year to date. You're looking at high numbers from the late last year. You could make that claim a little bit more precisely. But Tesla year to date down 40, and the other ones, and I sent you those numbers, everybody is down double digits but Meta. Apple's down 16%, Nvidia's down 14%. So when these stocks have come so far so fast that to take a little bit of what would we call it, enthusiasm out of their prices, we're not surprised. At Tesla, I'm surprised it's down that much. But new administration, the emphasis isn't on electric cars. They've taken away, what was it, some incentive to buy the car. You know, so you're going to see that come from a product like that. But if, again, knowing what you own goes a long way to your investment performance.
Mark, real quick before we let you go, there's process and there's results. People may criticize the process, but nobody knows the results of this yet because, I mean, you had a down week for the market, but...
Think warm. Think palm trees. Think baseball.
Hi, I'm MLB.com's Matt Monaghan. The long, dark freeze is over and spring training is finally here. If you're a baseball fan looking for a quick, easy way to get all the scores, top stories, and best sound bites from Florida and Arizona, you're in luck.
I don't think people realize how good we are. I don't even know if we realize how good.
The Morning Lineup Podcast, a short, less than 10-minute baseball highlight show, is available anywhere on any platform you listen to podcasts on, 5 days a week. We can't wait to meet you there.
Right. Who knows where we're going to be 2 weeks from now? So for people that are panicking, you would tell them what?
Well, Well, I mean, the Dow, look, pre-market trading, the Dow is up 227 points. So it's, you know, you got some rebound there. And again, you're talking about a different group of stocks when you talk about these market averages and what we use as examples of what, quote, the market is doing. So it's if you're satisfied with your portfolio, more importantly, why did you buy that portfolio to begin with? If it's doing what you want it to do, understanding you got some ups and downs, we're always going to have that. But if it's the stocks that you're comfortable with or the bonds or whatever investment you're in, well, then you stay in the course. If something has changed materially, let's pick on Tesla one more time and saying, well, it's no longer the product that maybe it's used to. The government emphasis is off. Maybe I need to do something differently. Well, the time to sell would have been a couple of weeks ago.
Thank you, Mark. We're out of time. We'll talk to you Monday when we take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday morning markets with Mark Petrino. And then somebody texted about home equity lines of credit at Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. You definitely offer those, right? And equity loans?
Yeah.
All
yes.
right, we got to go.
Yes,
late 7:56. Right. Go to jeffersonfinancial.org. Traffic now, WWL. 8:14, can't fake the funk, so I'm being honest with everybody. We got a little technical thing going on at the studio. I have to work from home. I have Teddy, the puppy, here. He might disrupt a little bit of what's going on. I'm doing my best to keep him at bay. Errol Williams joins us now, Orleans Parish Assessor with the City Services Coalition, as well as David Marcello, who is with the City Services Coalition. Good morning, gentlemen, and I'll try to keep the dog at bay.
Good morning, Tommy.
Let's talk about, I don't know whoever wants to start here or who wants to answer the questions, but y'all can take turns, I guess. Tell me about this, the plan to improve New Orleans, and how did the idea take shape? And then tell me about it and what it found.
David, you got that
Shall
one?
I start
or yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. Basically, go ahead.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Right.
Uh-huh. If y'all don't start talking, I'm going to get the dog to bark.
Okay. I'm sorry, Tommy. Okay. That's it. No, I met with Press Kavikoff, you know, about a year ago, and we were concerned that you know, certain things were not getting done in city government because of, you know, a strained relationship between the city council and the mayor. And we were saying, well, how do we get things done? Okay, and then, you know, people, there was a poll taken by Ron Forshay that said basically 70% of the people, both, you know, black and white, were not satisfied with government services. In my instance, I was only concerned about what affects the assessor's office, and that is permitting and licensing them. And from my view, I try and get the permit information as soon as possible to try and make sure that we keep our tax rolls, okay, in line with what the values changes are. So if somebody builds a new house, renovates a house, or, you know, puts an addition or demolishes a house, that we update our records to try and make that happen. Because of the shortage of staff and safety permits, okay, a lot of that information wasn't getting done. And then the city moved to a third party, vendor to try and do the inspections. But the problem I was hearing from a lot of the developers was that it was just taking too long to get a building permit. One guy who's been building houses for at least 20 years that I knew, he called me and says, I'm not building any homes in New Orleans. I said, well, why? He says, by the time I get my permit, my material costs are gone up and my profit's gone. So, you know, the key thing to us was to try and see what happened. But then the city recognized that was a problem, and they hired a firm called Matrix Group, who came in and evaluated the safety and permits department. They interviewed about 1,600 people online, as well as focus groups, to try and find out what were the problems. And there, you know, there were certain things in that in the discussion there with Press and I were talking about. Initially, we talked about maybe changing to city manager, and we're saying, no, that's not going to work, okay, because we don't want to neuter the mayor's powers or the city council. So basically, we started this process, and it went into five areas that we thought were important. Okay, and those five areas was crime and public safety, streets and infrastructure, drainage and water management, trash pickup and clean public spaces, and license and permitting. That's how we got where we are. And it's, you know, thanks to the foundations that put up the money, okay, to try and hire. We hired a firm called HRNA, okay, who goes around the country helping governments try and identify those their problems, and then get best practice and recommend best practices for government to be able to operate for the citizens.
David Marcello into the conversation. Uh-huh. David, when you hear about those five things that Errol just mentioned, that is basically what people depend on government to do, right?
Right. I think the concept was if you can't get the five basic things right, you're going to be challenged to do anything else efficiently. And we looked at it at two levels. We recognize these problems as systemic. They've been around for a good long time. We were hoping to find solutions that would endure from one administration to the next so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. And so we looked at the system level. We also looked at what we call granular solutions. What kind of operational changes close to the ground can you make within a particular subject area? An example of that, alluding to what Errol was discussing, safety and permits, is that we've proposed that there be a sort of concierge at safety and permits, somebody who takes your application when it comes in, stays with it and you through the process, doesn't just say, oh, go talk to the City Planning Commission or go talk to this, that, or the other group, but rather helps people get that application processed. So that is an example of the sort of change that we think would make things work a heck of a lot more effectively, a lot more efficiently.
Let me take a quick break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Errol Williams, Orleans Parish Assessor with the City Services Coalition, David Marcello with the Coalition as well, about this study. And they found out that five basic city service areas are severely lacking: crime and public safety, streets and infrastructure, drainage and water management, trash pickup and clean public spaces, licensing and permitting. And that's what you need government to do, right? I that's what I want government to do. I don't want government to get involved in people's social lives or this or that or the other thing. I don't think government's suited to do that, but they are suited to do those five things. We come back, we'll talk about turning this thing around and how do you go, is it like a speedboat or an aircraft carrier? I know one of the disturbing results of this was about the people that said they may not be in New Orleans 5 years from now. We've already lost a ton of population. We'll talk more about that when we come back. If you have any questions or comments, the Oakman Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line is open at 504-260-1870. Right now, time for traffic on WWL. 826, 827 now. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Errol Williams, Orleans Parish Assessor, and David Marcello, both with the City Services Coalition. Somebody texted in here and said, why don't we just get Jefferson Parish to tell us how they get all the safety and permits issued that they handle? The boss could probably spend a day in NOLA and tell us exactly what we need to change. Well, if I may channel my inner Johnny Carson, you are wrong, text breath, because in the next half hour, we're going to talk to Cynthia Lee Sheng, president of Jefferson Parish, who wants to revamp its permitting process because she says the current process is horrible. So it's not just in Orleans Parish. Gentlemen, Errol, I'll go with you. How do you go about turning this thing around? First of all, I presume it's more of an aircraft carrier than a speedboat. Errol? Errol, you got me on mute?
On the office phone.
All right, well, let's go.
Okay. Basically, you know, when you look at this process, we came up with, you know, summarizing maybe 6 to 8 points. One was streamline the permitting process and eliminate unnecessary tasks. That's one. The other was ensure completeness of the permits before it is filed and create a task force of personnel and developers trying to identify the choke points in the permitting process and devise solutions for that. Okay. Of course, we, you know, what David mentioned earlier, we do want to have a single person who oversees the permitting process from the beginning to the end. This helps get it through, but then develop a detailed checklist and mandate that is used in every inspection. Those are the, you know, some of the things. If you go to our website, okay, which is the New Orleans Coalition, you're going to see there's going to be a link to what they call the Matrix Group's report, and it goes into detail of every little piece of thing that safety permits needs to improve in order to make it more efficient. Keep in mind, Jefferson Parish and East Baton Rouge Parish, usually in 2 to 4 days you can get a permit processed. Okay, for us, sometimes it's taking several months to get that done. And some people are still waiting after a year trying to get approval on a permit. That's what I've been told by some of the people that I've interviewed with some of those. So we think that, you know, that the main focus of the group was to try and develop and strengthen the inner core operations for city government to improve the process with best practices so that we can enhance service delivery. That's the only objective of this New Orleans Coalition. We don't, you know, we don't care who the mayor is and who the city council is, just as long as they embrace some of these changes so that people will begin to feel comfortable that when they come to city government and they apply for a permit, that they are able to get it done timely, so you know, as and make sure that it's safe for what they do.
David, real quick before we let you go, because I know y'all are pressed for time, as are we, when it comes to the survey and results of people expecting to live in Orleans Parish 5 years from now, what'd it say? David Marcello?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hello? Okay. The results were alarming. This was a survey done in December, and the question was, what are your plans in the next 5 years? Do you plan to be here in New Orleans, or do you plan to move away? And a collective 40% of the people who were surveyed said that they thought within the next 5 years the possibility existed that they would move away. 83% of the people who responded said that they didn't think they were getting their money's worth from the services that they pay taxes to support. So we've taken those signs of distress to heart, and we think that the report, which is 216 pages long, sorry for that, but there are a lot of good ideas in it, and we think that it will help to inform the dialogue in the coming year. We are looking at elections in the fall of 2025. We'll have a new mayor and many new members of the city council installed by a year from now. And so we're hoping that over this campaign year, there'll be some discussion about the particulars of the report. The coalition is not into endorsing.
And maybe we can have you back and drill down some more, because 216 pages is hard to condense in 20 minutes. We'll take a quick break for news here on WWL. Then we'll come back, talk to Parish President Cynthia Lee Sheng about the permitting process there. Other than that, Ms. Lincoln, how was the play? 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Cynthia Lee Sheng joins us now, Jefferson Parish President, talk about the permitting process. We just were talking to people from the City Services Coalition, and they were talking about revamping their permitting process, as well as the other things that came up in their survey as it relates to the day-to-day services of government and the five basic areas that they recognize. We'll talk about some of them as well as permitting with Parish President Cynthia Lee Sheng. But first, we'll start with that. Good morning, Madam President. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. We're doing well. Thank you.
How is Mardi Gras and all of that stuff for y'all in Jefferson Parish? Everything turned out fine and a big weekend
coming
up? Wow.
Yeah, we have a really big Sunday coming up. We're calling it St. Patty Gras. So it's the Argus is going to be rescheduled on St. Patrick's Day, their parade, and they've been really, really wonderful. This whole St. Patrick's Day parade committee have been incredible, inviting Argus on their day. So we'll start off with Argus, and then we will move to St. Patrick's Day. And it'll be a big, big parade.
What time's all that start?
I think at 10 o'clock start.
Thankfully, you got a break from the weather. Thankfully, you got a break, so it should be a beautiful day for that. Let's talk about the permitting process in Jefferson Parish and what it is that you would like to revamp. What kind of problems are people having, Cynthia?
Well, let's just talk about this, the process in general. Obviously, this is being, you know, discussed in New Orleans as well, a process that if you look in any community, I think people will be complaining about this process. And I want to go through it because I kind of fell in the same trap as everybody else did before me, thinking it's a people problem. In Jefferson Parish, we've been looking at this. Gosh, many other parish presidents have looked at this process because you always get complaints from business owners or from residences for doing residential builds. And look, you know, first of all, there's already built in this hurry up and get it done. I've bought land. I'm paying taxes. I'm paying insurance. I'm paying professionals. There's just already a frustration that you're not doing it super quick. And then, of course, it's a lot of regulations that you're looking at. And I think we've gotten into the habit of sort of blaming the people. In Jefferson, I don't know about any other process, but kind of people tend to look at blaming the people or showing their frustrations on our staff. Our staff tend to, you know, get aggravated with people not submitting documents quick enough. So it's become over the years this, you know, he said, she said thing. And when I really looked into it, we made some changes to try to make it more efficient. I'm not saying any process can't be more efficient. We've done that already. But when I started really getting into it, I'm like, it's not a people issue. It's a process issue. And so I have a special task force, if you will, an advisory committee that we've just started asking the different organizations to submit a member to be on this task force. And we really need to look, I want everybody to understand the layered regulations that we're required to follow, whether they be state, whether they be just building code, or whether they're our own legislation that we've had to follow. And I want as many people to understand, look at what we're dealing with. This is more than a people issue. This is a process problem, and maybe we need to change the laws to make it a quicker, more efficient process.
Let me take a break. I want to pick it up there when we come back, Madam President, if we can, because a lot of people think there are quick, easy solutions, and there aren't. And in fact, parish government might be handcuffed in a way. Of course, the permitting process, the whole idea is to keep everybody safe, right? Make sure that the construction is done properly. However, if you've ever built a house, people know about, I think they know about interim financing, which is, you know, at that time, I don't remember what the outstanding balance was, or the interest rate was lower than it is now, but, you know, it was costing me $58 a day. Every time I had a delay here or a delay there as I was building the home I'm living in now, and everybody wants it done right now. But not everybody can have everything right now. So we'll talk about process versus people and how to fix it with Cynthia Lee Sheng about the permitting process in Jefferson Parish. If you have any questions, comments, Open Heart Jeweler Talk and Text Line is open, 504-260-1870. Traffic now, WWL. 57, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Cynthia Lee Sheng, president of Jefferson Parish. Big parade weekend. I just want to bring that up again because it was disappointing on Mardi Gras, but you got Argus and St. Patrick's Day parade rolling on Metairie Road starting at 10 o'clock Sunday. Weather's going to be beautiful. Let me read a text, Madam President. HVAC contractor here. Problem we have in Jeff Parish is that the inspectors take a week or more to get the job and inspect it. That's why we use third-party inspectors. Cost $75 more per inspection to hire the third-party inspector, but we do it because they'll come out within a day or two. Is staffing part of the problems? And when you talk about process and not people, expand on that, please.
Yeah, I think staffing is part of the process. And look, I would say we're seeing that staffing is affecting many of our departments, right? So that is always, if you can throw more resources at it, that will always help you. But I think, look, you look at that, the trades. That's just very one small section. In this context, I'm talking about the projects that take a long time. We have other things that happen that sometimes they get the permit the same day, or sometimes they get the permit within 3 days. But when you talk about maybe a new commercial project on Veterans Boulevard or something like that, where you're starting with just land, right? Mm-hmm. It's a long process, but there's many, many things you have to do. You look at the building, you know, is the building built right? The utilities, the parking, the landscaping, and within the building, all the building door frames, is it ADA compliant? Is it fire resistant? The ingress and egress. There's so many things. There's so many different departments within the parish that you might have to go through. Maybe our public works or our engineering. There's other legislative bodies you might have to go through, whether it's the planning advisory board. You might need a zoning change through the parish council, and even other state agencies you might have to go through. So you're just talking about a very complicated process, and every project is unique. So we can't make a template. Every single project is a unique project, whether with whatever use they're going to do. Is it retail? Is it industrial? Or where they are in the parish? If is it on a state road? Is it near a levee? You need levee board approval depending on the river height. It's very complicated. And so, like I said, in and of itself, it's going to be a long process because you just have so many regulations you have to abide by. So we've tried to look at the people issue to make sure our process goes as smoothly as possible. But the more I look at this, it's like a layered maze that we put people through. And our people are trying to help them navigate that maze. It's not our people's fault. But look, Tommy, why do we have these? It's because property is precious to us, and there's so many rules to protect neighbors and surrounding neighbors, maybe. Or say, like in Fat City, we wanted to make something different happen. We wanted a pedestrian-oriented core.
Thank you. All right, now that we got that out of the way, we're going to have a serious conversation. Thank you, Dave. Have a great weekend. With apologies to Teddy Coretta, astronomer at Lowell Observatory, rather, specializing in comets and asteroids. Professor, I thought, you know, we'd get it out the way, right, rather than have the snickering in the classroom. What do you think?
No, it sets the tone very effectively. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's talk about being an asteroid detective. Is that what you are?
I suppose it's a little bit of a romantic way to put it. I use telescopes on the ground and in space to figure out where asteroids are, where they're going, and measure what they're made out of.
I guess we should start by talking about what an asteroid actually is. I think some people think it is, but maybe don't.
Sure, sure. So, you know, if you ask a little kid what an asteroid is, they're probably going to say, oh, it's a space rock. And that's most of the way to being the whole story, right? Mm-hmm. It's the rocky stuff in the inner solar system, but, you know, these are objects that are smaller than the moon, smaller than Mars. They can still be hundreds of miles across, but most of the ones that get close to the Earth are just a couple of miles or smaller. You know, they're pretty varied, right? You know, I think people have this idea, oh, they're just rocks. Or maybe if they've gone meteorite hunting, they think they're all metal, right? But they can range from ones that are about as dense as water, really kind of fluffy dirt clods, all the way up to things that are just as dense as iron themselves. They're a really varied and interesting group of objects, and just a handful of them are a little bit dangerous.
Well, we tend to think of an asteroid, at least I do, as like this big, massive chunk of hardened lava, this piece of a mountain that broke off. But that's not necessarily the case?
Yeah, some asteroids, you're totally right, look and are just like hardened lava. They were formed by volcanic processes billions of years ago in the early solar system. But some are completely different. There are asteroids that are really, really bright, made out of material just like the moon is. There are asteroids that are actually darker than coal. You know, there are people who've spent their entire lives trying to figure out what these things are made out of, and they keep finding new kinds of asteroids. They keep finding new things they didn't think of before. There's a lot to learn.
So how do we know, like, in terms of density, is it like a rock? Is it like a sponge? Is it like a rotten piece of wood where it looks heavy, but it's really not?
No, that's the rotten piece of wood analogy is actually really fun and interesting. So we have a couple of different ways that we can learn what asteroids are like, what they're made out of, and maybe what their densities are. If we go up and visit them with a spacecraft, you can just feel the gravity of the asteroid pulling on the spacecraft. You can measure how massive it is and get a really good measurement of how big it is, how dense it is, you know, how much danger it might pose to us. But we know of over 1.5 million asteroids. We've seen about 10 with spacecraft. We have to do a lot of inference to get the others. So that means we're using telescopes on the ground to, for instance, look at how they reflect light. You know, just like how if you, you know, are out on a hike, you can probably tell the difference between dirt and rock just by looking at it, the color of the rock. We can do the same thing with telescopes to try to tease out their composition. Different compositions of asteroids reflect light differently. And because we can compare them to, for instance, rocks on the ground, maybe meteorites that have also fallen from space, we can compare how the two objects reflect light. And if they match, well, maybe they have the same properties. So we can kind of assume that, you know, maybe this rock that we found on the ground that has a density of, let's say, twice that of water, maybe that's a good analogy, a good model for this asteroid out in space that reflects the same kind of light.
I know about that rotten wood thing. True story, had a raccoon cornered, and I just wanted the raccoon to get over the fence and leave, so I decided to just pick up a piece of firewood and throw it at him and turn out to be one of them rotten pieces, and he just looked at me like I was crazy. So I ran in the house, and the story ended happily. When it comes to these lighter, less dense asteroids, I don't know what happens with gravitational pull, the atmosphere, et cetera. Are those harmless, or do we know how many hit the Earth each day?
That's a fabulous question. So you're totally right that as you go to these weaker and weaker and weaker asteroids, you know, when they decide to, you know, get close to us, or when they get close to us, they're not making a choice, you know. Right. When they hit the atmosphere, the weaker ones can break up really harmlessly. Not all of them, but it means that when we're worried about protecting the Earth, protecting everyday people from asteroids and the dangers they pose, these smaller ones we're just not as worried about. And the weaker ones we're just not as worried about. We do know that those are probably more common, so that means that there's a lot more of that stuff that hits the Earth. It just so happens that, you know, we're all happy and we don't have to worry about asteroids that much. It's just not a big issue, even if these things hit us all the time.
So let me take a step back here when we talk about the way they, you said they don't decide to. What is it that determines whether or not an asteroid hits the Earth or not?
Right. So broadly, we classify asteroids by the kinds of trajectories they're on, which part of the solar system they're in. Most asteroids, the vast, vast, vast majority, are what we call in the main asteroid belt. It's outside of Mars, really far away. But every once in a while, asteroids escape from the main asteroid belt and get a little bit closer to us. This is caused by just repeated slow pushes by Jupiter, by Mars, by Saturn, by the Earth, right? It's a slow, slow nudge, and it takes a long time to build up. So the asteroids that get close to the Earth are aptly named the near-Earth asteroids, and we know of about 30,000 of them. These objects, too, even if they're on an orbit that we know of really today, you know, as they get close to the Earth, their orbits get nudged and change over time. So that's part of why NASA and all the other space agencies don't just try to find asteroids, but continue to monitor them and track them afterwards, because their orbits can slowly drift. And as they drift, even if they wouldn't have hit us in the past, maybe they'll be a danger to us in a couple hundred years, a couple thousand years. We want to keep track of that sort of thing, because unless you're looking, you don't know what kind of risk you're in.
Do we know what causes them to change a trajectory? Is it all about gravitational pull, or is there something in space that causes that, or things we launch?
Sure. So there's sort of two factors. The big one, and I think the easier one to explain, is just the slow gravitational nudges from the Earth and the other planets, right? There's also the fact that as these asteroids warm up in the sunlight, they have to then, you know, re-radiate their heat. You know, just like if you pull a hot poker out of a fire, you're going to see it's glowing. Asteroids do that too. And considering some asteroids are really dark, they absorb a lot of sunlight and get quite hot. As they re-radiate the heat, as they, you know, let off that same sort of reddish light, that can slowly push their orbits as well. I know that sounds kind of complicated, and I think, you know, we didn't know this was a really big, let's say, thing to worry about until maybe the 1970s or 80s. But because we know about all the different ways that that process works, we call it the Yarkovsky effect, we can model it really effectively, we can understand it and predict it years, decades, centuries in advance. So all the different things that cause asteroids' orbits to change, we have a good way of modeling. We have a good amount of understanding of how they work.
So somebody texted in, and I want to open the Okunard Jeweler Talking text line here, because, look, there are no dumb questions when it comes to this, and I think I've already proved that. 504-260-1870. We're talking about asteroids and what kind of threat they could be to the Earth, and we're talking with a so-called asteroid detective, an astronomer at Lowell Observatory, which is in Flagstaff, right, Professor?
Yeah.
Specializing comets and asteroids. Sounds like the birds are out singing. No worries. We're bird friendly here. We like that. Is there some kind of, like, you know, we all have security systems in our home these days, right? We know if a door is open, or we know if some area is a secure area is has been violated or whatever. Is there one giant thing going around the Earth like that, where we know whatever it is that's either approaching the Earth or coming in, or that has landed?
No, that's a great question. We have a bunch of different systems that all do part of that. Mm-hmm. So the Earth's a big place, right? It means that we need lots of different countries to kind of pitch in to help figure out all the different ways to hunt for potentially dangerous asteroids, to track them in advance, and we're getting better at it all the time. We use, as sort of the first line of defense, there are groups of people at telescopes all around the world who spend all night, every night that it's not cloudy, scanning the night sky for new asteroids. This is what they do every day of every year, including the holidays. It's a really kind of a thankless job, and I think it's something that the public doesn't know too much about. There are people who kind of live almost a monastic lifestyle up on the mountain, just doing what they can to keep the rest of us safe. That's really good at detecting asteroids days, weeks, months in advance before they might do anything to get close to us, put us in any danger, and that's usually enough time that we can sort of make a plan. When it comes to sort of the smaller stuff that might be harder to find, you know, with telescopes, you're seeing these objects far away, so small stuff far away, they can be pretty dim. The smaller stuff is not often so dangerous. It'll burn up in the atmosphere, but that's sort of the next frontier, is we want to get even better at finding the smaller things that might not be, say, world-ending, like Armageddon or Deep Impact, right? But are still worth thinking about and tracking and, you know, preparing for.
Don't Look Up, a good movie as well. Jennifer Lawrence spent some time on a mountaintop making sure that we were all safe. How coordinated is that effort? And when you said it relies on countries cooperating, universities, government, tell you what, Professor, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. Nothing just happens, right? And the classic example I give is, even if it's a PTA meeting, somebody's got to set up the chairs and bake the cookies and put out the table skirts and all that stuff. So nothing just happens, I would think. It's especially complicated when it comes to scanning the universe to make sure that Earth's not in trouble of any killer asteroids. Got any questions, comments? 504-260-1870. I must tell you, with all the political this and that and the other thing, I'm more worried about asteroids than anything. That's what I think is going to do the Earth in. One of these days, somebody's going to miss something, and all of a sudden, we won't even hear boom. We'll just hear ka. More when we return, 260-1870, 504-260-1870, if you have any questions or comments. Friday morning, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 926, we're talking about asteroids. If you're looking for Ian McNulty, he was on yesterday, had a conflict, couldn't come on today as we normally do on Fridays. So you can find out all about eating and drinking if you go to WWL.com, find my name and click on the audio or download the Odyssey app. Either way, meanwhile, we're talking about asteroids and being an asteroid detective, so to speak, with Teddy Coretta, an astronomer at Loyal Observatory specializing in comets and asteroids. So, Professor, when it comes to this integration, if you will, this coordination of effort, who drives this? Things don't just happen, right? So if you're talking about scanning the universe to make sure that the Earth is either safe from asteroids or maybe having a an alternate plan, and we'll get to that in a minute about alternate plans, how coordinated is the effort? Is anybody in charge of this, or is it just a lot of people volunteering? Take me through that.
You're right. It's a complicated thing, and it takes a lot of people working together. It started kind of informally with the different international space agencies like the European Space Agency, NASA, of course, JAXA, the Japanese Space Agency, sort of developing their own plans in sometime in the early 90s, sort of right before asteroids got big in the news, right, when they started making all the big blockbusters. People started realizing that asteroids are a global threat. Right. When you discover an asteroid, you don't know if it's going to hit your country or someone else. You have to work together. In some sense, it's never actually been a huge issue to get the countries to work together. The question is, how fast can we do it? How well can we do the job?
So with that being said, are you fairly confident that there is enough coordination, enough funding, enough this, enough that to make sure that we continue to keep our eyes on the skies?
I think, you know, there's always a question of, do we have enough people and are we working fast enough? We're getting better at all of these things. And in particular, just as we sort of flex our muscles and actually go through these exercises, you know, I'm sure we're going to be talking about that asteroid that was in the news a couple of weeks ago, 2024 YR4 in a bit. But in particular, by doing these exercises, by following it through, we're getting better and we're getting better at working together. One of the challenges is, you know, it's not quite funding per se, but it's close to, do we have enough people and have we trained enough, you know, new students to take over when the current generation of scientists who maybe were the world's best in the early 2000s are starting to get, you know, think about retiring, moving in with their grandkids, right? You know, we've got to kind of plan for the future if we want to keep people just as safe now as they are in 20 years, right? It's both about planning and about actually running these exercises and getting better in the present.
So when it comes to relative certainty about protecting the Earth from any kind of asteroid, let's go back, since you mentioned, and talk about YR4, a city killer. Tell me what happened there.
Right. So this asteroid got discovered right around the holidays. I think it got discovered on the 27th of December. And, you know, like everyone else, the astronomers of the world take the holidays off, as they should. But, you know, one of the challenges there is that when you discover these asteroids, at first, you don't know, are they on a trajectory that's worth worrying about? It takes a couple of days, often a week or two, before you can actually kind of know, is it just going to get close to us or is this worth worrying about? So by maybe the third or fourth day of the new year, people started to notice, okay, this asteroid maybe has a chance of hitting the Earth. And, you know, we're not talking about betting odds, right? Astronomers care about the small stuff. We start caring when it's a tenth of a percent, you know, one part in a thousand, that's our chance of hitting the Earth. That's when we really start to think about it. Part of the reason there is that because asteroids can move quickly, our understanding of them can evolve quite rapidly. It means that, you know, we kind of need to start getting worried earlier than you'd expect. So the sort of international rule we follow is once somebody finds an object that has a 1% chance of hitting the Earth, you have to tell everyone. You actually were required to report it to the United Nations. We send it off to the other space agencies. It immediately becomes completely public information. There's no more, you know, me working on my own or our team working on our own. So for YR4, right around, you know, maybe that third or fourth day of the new year, that's when everyone started to realize, okay, it's time to take this really seriously. Let's go figure out where it is, where it's going, and if we can, what it's made out of. Part of the way that my team was involved in The efforts to kind of constrain whether or not we were in danger from this object was measuring what it was made out of. And we determined, using our big telescope outside of Flagstaff, that it was primarily rocky in composition. This is, like when we were talking about before the break, you know, the weaker asteroids you don't have to worry about, but the rocks, the metallic ones, those are a little bit more dangerous. YR4 was not some weak little friable thing. This was worth really caring about. So as a result, as the weeks went on, you know, we saw it more and more and more in the news as its impact probability grew. You might ask, how did that happen? We kept tracking it, right? So we saw its orbit continue to evolve and refine our understanding of it by repeatedly looking at it night after night after night with big telescopes. We were measuring where it was as precisely as we could. That way, we could kind of constrain the exact specific trajectory it was on. So in addition to not just measuring what it's made out of, we wanted to do our best to understand exactly how fast it was going, exactly where it was. And as we refined our understanding of its orbit, you know, in the news, people saw the impact probability kept rising to 1%, to 2%, to just above 3%. Once it got above about 2.5%, that means it was more likely to hit the Earth than any other asteroid of that size that we've detected in the past, right? This was a big deal. We hadn't had, you know, sort of a real big asteroid to worry about sort of since we really started worrying and developing these all-sky surveys back in the 90s to look for these asteroids. But then all of a sudden, the impact probability went to zero. The reason for that is that more or less, think of it like you're like focusing like the sight of a rifle or something, where like, you know, as it's kind of pulling into view, you start to see the Earth, but you still don't know exactly how focused you are. You still don't know the exact trajectory it's going to take. Once you get everything properly set and you actually know exactly where you're aiming, you kind of know immediately, is it going to hit the Earth or not? As you start to refine the orbit, kind of the area of, you know, the sky that it could be passing through shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, and all of a sudden the Earth is outside that circle and you're safe. That's what we've seen when we've run these computer models in the past, and that's what happened here in real life. But we've still never gotten to 3% before. It was a big deal. You know, my mom called me. She was worried, right? But, you know, it's because the scientists worked together and tried to rule in or rule out an impact as fast as we could. That meant we knew as early as we could to determine, do we have to deflect it? Do we have to do some sort of measure to work against it in a couple of years down the line?
How reliable is the science when it comes to, should an asteroid threaten a planet? I'm thinking Department of Defense applications here, either way, from whatever country, that you would be able to predict with some degree of certainty where it was headed?
We're actually really, really good at determining where these asteroids are going, in part just because, you know, the first asteroid actually got discovered about 200 years ago. Ever since then, we've just been getting better and better and better at finding asteroids, at tracking them, at understanding the trajectories they follow through the inner solar system. That whole part of it, that's really set. We know the exact process. You can't do much better than just go back to the telescope every night and just keep looking at where it's going and measuring where it's going over and over and over again. That's the bread and butter technique. It just works. The thing that we don't know as well, and this is what many scientists are working on right now, is thinking, let's say that we find an asteroid that will hit us. What are our options, right? Mm-hmm. What actual...
Well, let me take a step back, Professor. Plans? What about sure. like knowing where it would... Could you predict a continent where this thing would hit or not?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So... Okay. So for YR4, before we knew that it wasn't going to hit the Earth, we knew all the places along the Earth which it might hit. In particular, it meant that we knew exactly, you know, the exact like latitudes and longitudes that were possible. And as we understood this object's orbit better, that narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. For an object like this, if we knew for a fact it was going to hit the Earth, well in advance of it hitting the Earth, we would know exactly where on the surface it would hit. There's sort of two benefits to that. The first is most of the Earth's surface is the ocean, right? You know, if you want to roll the dice, most of the asteroids are going to end up in the ocean. That's still not, you know, no risk, but it's, you know, better than it hitting New York or Louisiana or whatever, right? The other thing is that if we know where it's going to hit, maybe we can evacuate people ahead of time. Maybe we can make a plan that's specific to that area and keep people safe.
So when it comes to if one country, say a hostile country, wanted the asteroid, if they find out, say, I'm just picking names out of the air here, country X is an enemy of country Y, and they know an asteroid is going to hit country Y, and they're saying, good, that'll wipe out Y, that the Y would know about it because of the shared information?
Yes. So as soon as any asteroid poses a real threat to the Earth, everyone knows everything. That's the policy. You're right that there are a lot of, let's say, overlapping questions between, let's say, like national defense and national security and asteroid science, right? Back in the 1990s, one of the reasons Congress first started getting interested in funding, you know, asteroid surveys to look for potentially dangerous space rocks was specifically this, you know, let's say two countries are on the brink of war and an asteroid is going to explode in the atmosphere above, you know, the border between the two of them. Even if it doesn't hurt anyone, you hear a big explosion in the atmosphere, you're already a little antsy, you might make a bad decision. You know, people get, you know, afraid of things from outer space, and large explosions are, you know, I think something that would cause a lot of people to jump to conclusions. We want to understand where these things are, sort of for everyone's benefit, to try to prevent exactly the situation you're describing.
So somebody texted in, I think it's a good question, maybe a good way to wrap up the conversation. An asteroid's coming, you know, it's a big one, it's going to be catastrophic. Okay, what do you do? Do you run up your credit cards and have a great time? Is there anything? What would happen then?
Well, that's exactly what NASA and so many other space agencies are doing right now. A couple of years ago, your listeners might remember, we did something called the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART. This was NASA's big mission to try to push an asteroid onto a different trajectory. We'd never done this, right? We didn't know how well that kind of technique works, and I'd much rather know if it worked or not before we're in a situation where we have to use it, right? So in that particular case, we realized that if we found an asteroid, let's say with 10 years of advance warning, something like DART, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, we could just push it onto a different trajectory that wouldn't hit us. It's cheap, it's fast, it's reliable. But if we discovered something with, let's say, less lead time, 6 months, 2 years, kind of like the scenarios they bring up in the movies, we're working on exactly the right plans for that right now. You know, the classic one that they bring up in the movies is let's hit it with a missile, right? Mm-hmm. But there are people who are working on that with PhDs, working in big government labs with big supercomputers, figuring out the exact way that we should do it to be the safest, to be the most reliable. You know, scientists are worried about this just like anyone else. And while I think sometimes it can seem like science fiction to say, let's go hit the asteroid with a missile, we might in our lifetimes find a scenario where that might be the right choice. But we want to know everything we can about that beforehand so we can make a safe choice for everyone involved.
And before we let you go, when you see things depicted in the movies are, I can't think of them right now, they have several of them, but would the effects be like that, similar to that? Do the movies pretty well nail it, or do they over-exaggerate it?
The movies are definitely a little over-exaggerated. And often, you know, the movies, they're trying to be flashy, right? They're trying to get, you know, butts in seats, sell tickets. And as a result, the asteroids that they even show hitting the Earth are a lot bigger than the ones that asteroid scientists are typically worried about. Most asteroids aren't the size of Texas, like in the movie Armageddon. They're a few miles across. So that means that most often, the kinds of scenarios we're worried about, it's not, you know, the end of human civilization. It's damage over a wide, wide, wide area. And it would still be tremendously awful, tremendously dangerous in lots of different ways. But the way that they present it in movies, they're trying to make it look as cool as possible. And in a lot of ways, we're still figuring out exactly what an asteroid impact would look like. We know a lot of the big picture details, but we're working out the small stuff all the time. And I'm actually at a conference this week where we're talking about exactly this. What do asteroid impacts do, and how dangerous would they be?
Professor, a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for your work. I appreciate it. Teddy Coretta, an astronomer at Lowell Observatory, specializing in comets and asteroids. If you had to say, Professor, how many things are above the list of things you worry about as it relates to asteroids hitting the Earth? How many? 1,000? 2,000?
It's definitely a couple hundred. You know, I live
a couple of hundred. All right. Well, there you go. That's different. Thank you, sir. 9:40, 20 till 10. JR has been on fire. We'll have a free pick for us as well as some other information when we return. JR with Taking Vegas right now. Time for WWL traffic. All right. Here we go. 9:47, 13 till 10. JR, I got to tell you, first of all, good morning. Happy Friday.
Good morning and happy Friday to you, man. Couldn't be more pumped up off a huge 2-0 last night. So I got to tell you, man, we're ripping it, even in the NBA. College basketball, obviously, we're always killing it. I'm going to say this because I know people, a lot of my clients listen, and I like that they know that I'm very transparent. We had a slight losing streak here. Didn't last very long, just a couple of days. We easily snapped it yesterday, 2-0 last night, big time for all of our clients. And I got to also say I'm so pumped up about the upcoming week. And, I mean, look, three big winners. Anyone that texted last week, the week before that, to get my NBA game of the week got blowouts. Last week was a tight one. We had Denver. We gave it out early at -7. Hopefully you guys got it right away and put it in because it did go higher later in the day, but they did win the game by 8 points. So text the word win to 545454. Got my NBA game of the week again, absolutely free via text message. No hype, no hassle. Just text the word win to 545454. Let me take care of you with a blowout in the NBA happening tonight.
You have been on fire with your free on-air picks. I know we got one coming up. Y'all stay tuned for that because, you know, I'm old school, JR. I go to the sports book, and the lady at the window is looking at me sideways now. Every week I'm in there cashing.
Well, I can tell you, I know you built the lake house last year off the off the winners. This year I'm thinking that you either put a real nice RV out front that you're going to take with you or a big old extension on that lake house.
Actually, got hired some cocktail waitresses.
I don't blame you.
No, but seriously, you have been on fire, and we'll get to that in a minute. Let's talk about money management because you talked about, you're honest enough, you said we had a little losing streak, then you got it back. But that's where money management comes in. It's all about, I guess, progressions, if you will, and knowing when to go, when not to go. It's all about the math, and that's where you excel. That's what you do.
Well, and that's why, you know what, people don't ever complain. If we lose two or even three games, I want them to happen in a row because we're losing minimal amounts on each one of those losses. We go back to single units after a loss because, I mean, look, I hit a very high percentage for my best clients. Obviously, we're right now on my top plays documented over 70%. But that doesn't mean that we're just going to go 3-1, 3-1, or 2-1, 2-1. There's going to be 5, 6, 7 wins in a row. Like, we just had an 11-game heater 2 weeks ago. 11 games in a row. We quite often hit 5, 6, 7 in a row constantly. So when I lose, and because once you lose a game, you hit 5, 6, 7, you're pressing, not all of your money, ever. You're putting more on the line, though, right? Each time, if you bet 5,000, the next bet might be 55, and then 6, and then 6,500, whatever the progression that I'm using at the time. But when you lose, you go back to square one. You may only be betting 1,000 a game. So now if you lose 2 or 3 in a row, they're single-unit losses. Whereas when you're winning, you're picking up a unit and a half, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 units on a single bet. So if you know what you're doing, you understand the math, and you really know strategy, which is something I have studied for 30 years in this business. I have multiple strategies I'll ask people to implement throughout their time of, you know, doing business with us. And, you know, the reason why we're so good at what we do is because we understand it better than the average person. You may be good at picking games. You might even be good with math and strategy, but to be great at both of them is truly a rare commodity, especially in this industry.
It's all about strategy, about logic, about math, and leaving the emotion out of it. And when you do go on a rough patch, sometimes you have the tendency to chase it, and that's where you get in trouble. Talk about that, JR.
No doubt about it. In fact, you know, one of the things that I think is key, and the people I do business with, when it comes to the games, they are the word I just used. They're soulless, right? You can't have emotion. You can't allow a team that's nipped you in the bud 3, 4, 5 times in a row allow you to dictate whether or not you're going to use them again or go against them
either.
Again.
Or the other way around. If they're hot for you, you can't.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, the guys, you know, homers are everywhere, all over the country. People are betting on their favorite teams, which is insane to me. You don't want to do that. You need to have an unbiased opinion if you're doing this to make a couple of extra bucks for yourself. Now, if you don't mind throwing money away because you're just entertaining yourself, and of course, sports betting, period, is entertaining, but I want to take that small entertainment and turn it into a really substantial amount of money so that you might be able to look at this through a different lens and have that businessman mentality. So, again, game of the week, guys. NBA game of the week is yours absolutely free. It's going to be a blowout. We've given you this 4 weeks in a row, 4 weeks in a row. It has won for you, and we're going to do it again today in blowout fashion. Text the word WIN, W-I-N, just text WIN to 545454. And like I said, no strings attached, no hassles, none of that. You just get the game via text message. Text the word WIN to 545454.
Somebody texted me earlier and said, no kidding, that your picks have been more providential for them than has Social Security this month. I know you've been on fire with your free on-air picks. The lady at the sports book is looking at me sideways, but she probably could look at me again this week sideways. What do you got for us on air for a free pick?
Yeah, she's not just going to be looking at you sideways on this one. She may be cross-eyed when you're done with this one. Yeah. So I can tell you this. Look, Duke, they're going to have issues. And I'm not one that's really big on betting against or with injuries, but their sixth man is going to be out, which is probably the best sixth man in the country, plus Cooper Flagg, everyone knows, got hurt yesterday. Mm-hmm. That line is down to 7.5. I don't just like – I absolutely love North Carolina plus the 7.5. I may be giving this out by the time we get to game time as what we call a false favorite, where mm-hmm. we'll actually have folks not only bet them plus the 7.5, but we'll have a portion of the bet that we want to put on this one game that will be going money line. So that's going to be a nice one. And look, UNC, I don't want to call them a bubble team. Chances are they're already in, but obviously beating Duke tonight outright would be huge for them, even with the injuries to Duke. So I think they're going to go all out. They're going to pedal to the metal and absolutely try to throttle Duke, where Duke's, they're not going to be playing with much depth. They're going to be exhausted, and their mentality is going to be a little bit down. It's a really good spot for UNC in a great rivalry game to get back to, where they need to be. So get in UNC plus the 7.5. But again, let me give you a blowout, guys. NBA blowout winner, my game of the week in the NBA. It's absolutely free. You get it via text message. Text the word WIN. WIN to the number 545454. You're going to get it absolutely free.
All right. Thank you, JR. Let's go out there and what?
Hey, you know what to do, man. Guys, it is that time of year. I'm going to be in Vegas on Wednesday, by the way. When we talk next week, I'll be in Vegas. So let's go out there and let's make some money.
Thank you, JR. He'll be on tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock, WWL.